This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Korerotia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Nō mai haere mai ki tēne hōtaka, Speak Up, Korerotia. Ko Sally Carlton ahau. Te kūpapa o te rā, hei human trafficking. Human trafficking is deemed one of the major human rights problems of the world today. Indeed, it's often referred to as modern-day slavery. Today we're going to hear from four expert guests involved in trying to combat this issue to talk about what actually is human trafficking, the scale of the problem, what's being done, and what more still needs to be done. Our guests are Ralph Simpson, who's country director of NVADA, Michelle Pratt and Nikki Prendergast, co-founders and co-directors of Child Labour Free, a New Zealand organisation, and Christina Stringer, who's at the University of Auckland in the Department of Management and International Business. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the various things that you bring to these discussions. So Christina, how about we start with you? What got you involved in this?
Thank you, Sally. In order to really understand my interest today in human trafficking, we need to go back a few years. In 2008, I undertook a research project for the Ministry of Fisheries, now the Ministry of Primary Industry. The Ministry was very keen to gain an understanding of the amount of fish that was caught in New Zealand waters and was exported to China for value-added processing and then exported from China to our key markets in Europe and North America and even brought back here and sold in the domestic market. During the course of that research, my research colleague and I identified a business model based on slavery. And this was slavery in the foreign charter vessel sector of the New Zealand fishing industry. Now, we finished that project, and at the end of that project, a coalition of NGOs approached me and said, OK, you've done work on human trafficking in the fishing industry. We know exploitation is happening in New Zealand land-based industries. Can you undertake some research to gauge the extent that it's occurring?
Christina's working with a coalition that comprises four NGOs: the Pressure Initiative, Stand Against Slavery, HAGAR, and ECPAT. And it's called the Human Trafficking Research Coalition. In December 2006, Christina and the coalition released the findings of her research: Worker Exploitation in New Zealand, a Troubling Landscape. And how about you, Nikki and Michelle?
Sure. So I suppose our journey started similar to Christina's in that Michelle and I have been working in the early childhood world for nearly over 30 years each, and we started supplying resources to ourselves and then to other external early childhood services, and just started asking the questions of who is making these products and where are they being made, and very quickly came up with the answer that we didn't know. So went out to sort of try and we just presumed that there'd be something out there that could tell consumers where these products are being made and by who, and there wasn't. You know, we could find cruelty-free and we could find not tested on animals and we could find free-range, but nothing that actually said that children weren't being used in the manufacturing of resources. And so that's kind of where our journey started.
I think that, this is Michelle just picking up. I mean, it astounded us that not tested on animals existed, but there was nothing about children. How sad is that? You know, like our most precious items in the world to every family, our children, hasn't even been considered. And consumers have the right to understand who does make their products. We were just quite astounded that it didn't exist. So hence the start of Child Labour Free.
And Child Labour Free is a consumer-led movement that we provide a certification that gives consumers the power to make conscious purchases by simply choosing products with the Child Labour Free mark. It was established in 2015 here in New Zealand, and we're in our third year now, so it's been quite the journey.
It's great that there are two New Zealand-founded organisations doing such cool work as well.
Thank you.
It's a very interesting point you make about animal testing and child labour, actually. It puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
There's also things on Rainforest Alliance. You know, like we care about our forests and we care about what happens in our rainforests. But again, nothing around children.
Yeah, very interesting. And Ralph, how about you?
I was a litigation partner at Bell Gully for 30 years. About 10 years ago, I was starting to think about what I might do before I finished working, sort of contribute back, and discovered human trafficking. So that would have been about 2007, which started a journey for my wife and I, looking to come to Southeast Asia to get involved. And I retired from my law firm in 2014 and took up the role of country director of Invader. So Invader's a New Zealand founded NGO, non-government organisation. We are based in Thailand in Chiang Mai, and our mandate is to tackle sex trafficking and child begging trafficking. We do that by working with the Thai law enforcement agencies to identify, investigate and convict those engaging in that crime. We also have two other teams that assist victims of trafficking. We have a team of social workers that go on police interventions and monitor the welfare and dignity of the victims who have been rescued, and oversee their welfare as they move into government shelters and then are repatriated home. And a Thai lawyer who represents victims in criminal trials of their offenders seeking compensation on their behalf.
It must have been a bit of a change. Were you living in New Zealand beforehand?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm sure we'll hear a lot about both Child Labour Free and Invader and what they do as we go forward. But my first question for all of you is, what exactly is human trafficking? I think it's one of those things that's quite a big concept, and it would be helpful to try and get some kind of defining mechanisms around it, perhaps, before we move on.
Perhaps I could start with a strictly legal definition. That might help. So under the Palermo Protocol, which is the United Nations protocol, which forms the platform by which nations are required to enact anti-trafficking legislation, there are three elements. There's the act of trafficking, so that's recruiting, transporting, transferring, harbouring, or receiving victims. And then the second element's means, so there's either some form of coercion, so it might be the threat or use of force, abduction, abuse of power or vulnerability. And then the alternative to that is fraud or deception, so you trick victims. And then the third element is the purpose of exploitation. And the purpose really defines the different types of trafficking. So there's obviously sexual exploitation, so prostitution, child pornography, there's labour, forced labour, slavery, that sort of thing. There's the removal of human organs. And then there are some lesser known ones, pressing people into begging rings, forced marriage, and forced soldiers, particularly child soldiers, in some of the conflict zones, in particularly Africa. But from, if we stand back and just from those legal definitions, I think one of the best definitions I've heard is the exploitation of vulnerability, because despite what we might see on television movies like Taken, this is really a poor person's problem. It's the exploitation of the world's poor people and the displaced. So refugees, irregular migrants, people fleeing conflict, people fleeing natural disasters. And those people are then traded as commodities for the profits of this, of their masters or their traffickers.
And if I could just add to that, to what Ralph has said just a little bit, Ralph outlined the three components, the act, the means and the purpose, and we can look at the act as what is done, we can look at the means as how is it done, and the purpose, why is it done. So, you know, the act, as Ralph said, it goes from recruitment to deployment, so what is done, the means, how it's done, how is that person controlled, and the purpose, why it's done.
Ralph, you mentioned that particularly vulnerable people are at risk of human trafficking. Are there any particular groups within those vulnerable groups that are particularly exploited? And I guess children might be one. We've got Child Labour Free with us. But other groups as well?
Women and children are the primary targets. They make up the majority of people trafficked. So women and girls alone make up between 60 and 70%, depending on which agency's publishing the statistics. Irregular migrants are a primary target. So in Southeast Asia where I'm working, it's Lao girls, Myanmar girls, Cambodian children. So the Cambodian children trafficked into child begging, Lao, Myanmar girls trafficked into the commercial sex industry. In Vietnam, it's poor women trafficked into forced marriages. In China, and children into sweatshops. So for different regions, there are different targets, but it's always, it tends to be those type of groups. In the fishing sector, it's mainly men, including younger men, primarily because they want physically stronger people to cope with the hours and the strenuous work that's required. So don't often see women trafficked into the fishing sector. But in construction, you'll get both men and women, and horticulture the same.
Michelle and Nikki, have you got anything to add?
No, I suppose, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about that later on around New Zealand, but and Christina, in terms of around the purpose of human trafficking, and I think sometimes it's just, even child labour, human trafficking, child labour, it's such a huge conversation that people shy away from it and think, in particular in New Zealand, not in our backyard. But when you actually start to drill down the fact that, if you look in New Zealand and we've got agricultural workers who are working for under the minimum wage, they have their passports held by agents. When you start to explain and extrapolate that out and understand that that is human trafficking, that is forced labour, then it becomes a much more sort of real issue for people.
I think that's one of the things, isn't it? We don't think about it as occurring here.
No, we don't. Or it becomes a problem that's so massive that people just shut down and don't want to discuss it. So it's about trying to make it real for people.
Michelle, and too, also in terms of consumerism, we all purchase and buy products. So even though we're talking New Zealand often in instances, we are purchasing and we are buying products from these countries and then in turn supporting the ethos of what happens within those environments. So I think also it's about consumer awareness and information, and where do we find that information to help us make better decisions.
Just one final question before we finish this segment. When I was looking into this, I noticed that it was some of the research was making it very clear that human trafficking is not the same as people smuggling. And I'd be really interested just to hear any comments you have on that distinction, because before I saw that, I had sort of thought they might be related.
There's a broad distinction that can be made between people smuggling and human trafficking. In general, the individuals will pay a smuggler to gain them illegal entry into a country. When we look at human trafficking, these are people that are often forced into entering another country.
That makes it really clear. Thank you very much, Christina. So we're already out of time for our first segment. And Ralph, we've got your choice of song.
It's Maxine by Sharon O'Neill from the 1980s.
Thank you.
Looks like another finest.
You're listening to Speak Up Kōrero Tia, and today we're discussing human trafficking and what some New Zealand groups are doing to counter this. We're going to be talking now about some statistics. Just how big is the problem?
According to the International Labour Organization, there are in the vicinity of 21 million victims of forced labour. And these are people that have no control over their rights or working conditions. Then we also have the Walk Free Foundation that estimates there's about 46 million people that are victims. And the problem is we're talking about a hidden population for which there's no sampling frame that exists. However, in March this year, the ILO and the Walk Free Foundation announced that in September, at the 72nd UN General Assembly, they will release a single global estimate of victims of forced labour. And I think what will happen is that, you know, when you have a global estimate, that'll help raise the profile of the issue.
It comes back to what Nikki was saying before, or Michelle was saying before, about the scale and how difficult to comprehend it is.
Yeah, just to put that in perspective, 21 million people is nearly the population of Australia. 46 is the population of Spain. These are highly controversial, and in the case of the Global Slavery Index, the 46 million, highly criticised estimate. And to be honest, from my perspective, too much time is being wasted and too much money wasted on trying to capture the number. It will always be based on significant amounts of extrapolation. I think in the case of the Global Slavery Index, the actual number of people interviewed on which that extrapolation based is minute, which means are we wasting time fussing about, I think it was 470 individuals responded providing raw data, and the 46 million number is an extrapolation on that 470 people. So, you know, one wonders, is there any point in the ILO and the Global Slavery Index or UNODC or the US State Department continuing to try and quantify the number? Clearly we're talking about tens of millions of people, and really that should be enough, and we should stop spending money on that now and spend it on trying to tackle the problem.
And this goes back to my earlier comment that, you know, the victims of slavery or human trafficking, they're a hidden population. And there's no sampling frame that exists to really capture the exact number.
Yeah, that's right.
I think also, too, you add in the ILO's number of children, specifically in child labour, at the estimate at 168 million. It's unfathomable. I mean, 168 million children involved in child labour, on top of the 46 million that's estimated, it's a substantive issue.
I really like what you're saying, Ralph, in terms of, you know, how much time is spent actually discussing numbers and how much time is actually spent looking for solutions and solving the problem. 168 million, UNICEF estimate 150 million children, you know, they'll all be getting their statistics from different sources and data. That 168 million, 150 million, that number hasn't changed in the sort of 5 years that I've been sort of on this journey. That's a really valid point.
Do we have a sense of why the scale is so big?
I think there's a couple of reasons. So if we look on the supply side first, we've got significant numbers of highly vulnerable, impoverished populations, displaced populations who are looking for options to gain either economic prosperity or at least survival. You know, if we talk about the impoverished population of the world, it's, you know, 1 billion approximately. So that creates an enormous pool of victims that are highly vulnerable to exploitation. They generally live in the third or developing countries where the criminal justice systems are weak. And many of them are either tribal minorities or different cultural groups, ethnicities, where the population in control, the wealthy, the powerful, lack empathy towards those for historical or cultural reasons. And that situation's made worse by conflicts in Syria, for example, natural disasters, economic disparities, and in that context, global warming represents a dark cloud on the horizon. But if we then turn it to the demand side, we've got problems like the underlying political and economic structures that perpetuate and reward exploitation. So the global economy relies heavily on the exploitation of poor people's labour to maintain growth. Global migration entrenches vulnerability and contributes directly to trafficking. Poor cultural attitudes towards commercial sex services creates demand for young girls and poor women to make themselves available for traffickers for sexual exploitation and child pornography. And the difficulty we've got is that the United Nations, the US State Department, and other global agencies, including very wealthy people who have now entered the sector. Let's take Andrew, I've forgotten his last name,
Forrest.
The guy behind the Global Slavery Index, yeah, Forrest. You know, these people, the way the Global Slavery Index is set up and the US TIP report, the Trafficking in Persons report, really targets poor countries as being to blame. So if you're America, New Zealand, Australia, England, Western countries, you're in the first tier, you're a good country, you're meeting your obligations under the Palermo Treaty. Whereas if you're a poor country or a developing country with difficulties, then you're in tier two watch or tier three, the worst countries. So it sort of passes blame to the third world. But the reality is, it's the first world that maintains those economic structures. I mean, where are the companies, or who are the companies that utilize sweatshops in Asia to make cheap clothes? They're American, they're multinational companies, and they're doing it for Western consumers. So what I personally would like to see is a shift of blame away from the poor towards the wealthy countries, so that they started taking responsibility for the fact that it's their economic structures and their consumer demands for cheaper and cheaper products that is to blame for this problem. And then, of course, we've got weak criminal justice systems in the third world countries, lack of funding, lack of training, lack of expertise, which makes the job difficult.
And if I can just talk into the consumer side of that, absolutely agree that the way that we've, the way we purchase, the way we consume products is very different to the way we used to do it, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Gone are the days where you would save for something, lay by it, you know, buy two lots of, so you buy a winter season and a summer season. Now it's every week we're purchasing things quicker, faster, you know, I need it now, is how people consume. And there is no, often, I shouldn't say there isn't, though, because people are, you know, things are changing, but, you know, often there's no thought given as to how has that product got to us. You know, how is it every week we're having a different season in a store? And how is that product coming to us at $5 for a T-shirt?
Christina, you should also contribute here to how, like, take the fishing sector in Southeast Asia is being propped up by slave labour.
And particularly, I'd be interested to tie in the New Zealand case as well, which you might be good to talk to.
Well, I mean, if we look at the fishing industry in Southeast Asia, they're very much supplying the, Ralph, have you said, the developed country markets. And the price pressure points are forced back down the supply chain. And I think that some of the fishing companies, they operate at the point where the only savings they can possibly make is on labour, which leads us to forced labour and slavery in the industry.
Yeah, and you'll see that in the factories. I mean, we visited some factories in India, and we met a particularly progressive owner who was awesome and really was incredibly open with us and talked about the pressures of the corporates or the big brands that he was working with, and saying, you know, they want this and they want it by Friday, so it's Monday, they want it by Friday, but they don't want to increase what they're paying for that. So exactly what you just said, Christina, you know, they don't want to compromise quality. So the only thing that factory is left to do is to push down on wages and workers. I think Dr. Imbel Hunting did some research, and, you know, she talked about something like a 2% increase across products if we were paying minimum wage or living, I think it's living fair wages. you know, 2% on a product to know that somebody was being treated fairly seems pretty minimal in my mind.
Are there any laws, I guess, like we have laws around various products needing to say if they've got peanuts, for example? Are there laws around companies needing to state where their products have come from?
California and in the UK, there's both countries now require producers and suppliers to those markets to demonstrate that they have got a slavery-free supply chain. But to my knowledge, apart from those two, I'm not aware of them existing in other jurisdictions. I suspect we're beginning to see the tide changing on that. We don't have anything in New Zealand or Australia, to my knowledge, but certainly the California statute and the UK statute will start to it.
Yeah. Actually, there's been significant cases of exploitation that's hit the media. And at the moment, the Australian government is considering a Modern Slavery Act based upon the UK Modern Slavery Act. And I think New Zealand should be looking at a Modern Slavery Act.
I agree.
There's been some discussion in Australia. I know that they have started a dialogue or a discussion around the work that was done around the UK Modern Slavery Act 2015, and I know that they have carefully looked at the California Transparency Supply Chain Act and were looking at, also the Netherlands had done some extensive work around what they were doing as a nation in terms of where to from here and had been monitoring those two acts.
Well, just to finish off then, one of the questions I'd like to ask is, why do people get involved in human trafficking? And you guys have touched on the fact that there are pressures from the consumer markets, but I imagine there are also a lot of personal gains that people can benefit from modern day slavery as well.
I would have thought the reasons are twofold: high profits, if you're a human trafficker, you make enormous money, and low risk of being caught and punished. And really, that's what it is. It's about greed and knowing you're over that.
Yeah, it's about profits, and it's also about the necessity of victims to sustain themselves and their families. You know, it stems from extreme poverty. And we also have to remember that in terms of forced labour, a worker may voluntarily enter into an employment contract, but from that point on be a victim of forced labour. So, you know, desperate to claw out of poverty, they have a job opportunity, and they enter voluntarily into that employment contract, and that, from that point, become a victim.
Here we have the song Human Trafficking by Steel Pulse, obviously very appropriate for today's topic.
The International Labour Organization believes there are almost 21 million victims of trafficking around the world.
I got involved in prostitution when I was 14.
Since about 15, I've been doing prostitution.
There's a terrible darkness coursing through the veins of America. Most have no idea it's there, and some choose not to know. But every night, hundreds of American children are being sold for sex in their own country.
Dear God, I fight, we must win.
Here, and we're talking human trafficking. We've just been talking about some of the reasons why it's such a massive problem. And in this segment, we're going to be thinking about what are some of the measures that are put in place to try and discourage or to prevent human trafficking. And Ralph, you've already mentioned it's incredibly unlikely that people will get found out. And I presume that's part of the difficulty as well. How do you even begin to tackle this problem?
Yeah, so when the Palermo Protocol was promulgated by the UN, there was a strategy developed to accompany it. It's called the three Ps: prevention, protection, prosecution. So prevention is really a twofold pronged approach in those days, although it is starting to broaden, about educating vulnerable populations about the risk of them being trafficked and trying to increase their economic prosperity so that they were less likely to take, for example, risky employment options or risky migration routes. Then there was protection, which was about really targeting at victims of trafficking, so rescuing them, putting them in safe shelters, reintegrating them, educating them, trying to protect them. And then the third P is prosecution, which is obviously finding the criminals and convicting them and putting them in prison. And since that time, two other P's have arisen: partnership, which isn't really an anti-trafficking strategy itself. It's really about trying to bring stakeholders together so that you get efficiencies, and policy, which is about improving government policies. But again, they're not really strategies in themselves for preventing human trafficking. And in one sense, protection isn't either. It's really the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff rather than the fence at the top. And my own view is, and maybe it's a reflection of my bias because of my legal background, but trafficking is a crime, and generally we tackle crime by convicting and punishing criminals through the criminal justice system. So, for example, if we take house break-ins in, let's say, South Auckland, if they were on the rise, we would be putting more police in that region to find the criminals and put them in jail rather than educating people about, you know, maybe they should be locking their doors or securing their possessions. And I think part of the problem we've got is that too much money and too much attention has gone into some of these programs where there's not a lot of behavioral science evidence to support the effectiveness of them, and too little money and attention has gone into building up and strengthening criminal justice systems, particularly in these developing countries. And as we start to see that emphasis change, we're starting to see results. So just in Thailand, over the last 3 years, the government that came in 2014 has really put a lot of emphasis on building the criminal justice system. And we are now seeing tangible criminal deterrence building in the commercial sex industry.
Nikki and Michelle, have you got anything
to
add?
Well, I'd love to ask Ralph a question.
Yeah, do. Sure.
You've got me kind of just, I'd love to talk to you for the rest of the day. But in terms of making those changes in government, what part do you think, you know, what part does the consumer play? Like, you know, in terms of supply and demand, and in particular, well, not in particular, but certainly, you know, I guess one of the things we've done is done some work with FreeSet, and they obviously work in India with women who are forced into the sex trade. And, you know, I've talked to them about how much time are they, you know, their core business is obviously working with the woman and offering them freedom. But obviously, while there's still a demand for their services, there's just going to be, for every line that they remove, there's another, you know, line of woman to take their place. So about educating people to, you know, not be wanting that service. So how much of that change in local governments and or international governments do you think comes from people saying, you know, enough is enough and we're not doing this anymore?
I appreciate the sensitivity or insensitivity of what I said a few moments ago.
I didn't take it as insensitivity at all. I'd love to know your opinion. Yeah.
The problem is that this issue is getting away on us, and it's time for some really tough decisions. Actually, after this call, I should give you a reference to a paper that was issued by six UN agencies in January, February of this year, which targets the different strategies that are being pursued around the world and identifies some significant weaknesses in them. The difficulty we've got is, one, I'm pretty cynical about consumers. I know we can teach some consumers that, you know, they really need to be more focused on the supply chain, but there will always be enough consumers that saying, yeah, but this dress from this company is only going to cost me $20, whereas the one that's got a clean supply chain is $45, and I can get two dresses for that price, and gee, I'm sorry about the slave thing, but I'm going to go and buy the cheap one. And then when we turn to, well, if we turn away from things like the clothing sector or even the fishing sector, you know, the people wanting prawns that have been shelled, and there's a lot of slave labour in that sector, even in relation to the processing of them. But if we turn to commercial sex, do we really think we're going to stop men in these countries wanting sex? I mean, it's a pretty tough call to say we can change consumer demand for people wanting prostitution services. So, and the trouble with victims, you're right. I mean, there's 1 billion poor people in the world, so I can take, you know, 10 million prostitutes out of the sector, and within 6 months there'll be another 10 million in there. And if we talk earlier about the Global Slavery Index saying there's 46 million people in slavery around the world, we cannot rescue 46 million people. I mean, let's be honest, the world has not been able to cope with the 12 million refugees out of Syria, let alone 46 million people in slavery. But the smallest population at fault here, so if we take the potential number of victims, 1 billion, the actual number of victims, 46, those numbers are just huge. If we take traffickers, maybe that's 4 million. That's a number we can deal to. And we don't need to convict all traffickers. We just need to convict enough of them to convince the rest of them that the business they're in is too risky to stay and get out. And that's what we're starting to see in Thailand, where we're starting to see brothel owners kick the young girls out of their brothels because it's too risky and the prison sentences are now too tough.
Cool.
It's positive to hear that there are some changes taking place, Ralph.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it's been very encouraging, actually, on what has otherwise been a pretty gruesome 2.5 years.
I'd be really interested in hearing about if any of you have some information on the human trafficking conviction here in New Zealand, which was just last year. And we touched on the fact that it's very difficult for a lot of people here to recognise that it's an issue. It seems so removed from our day-to-day life. But there was this conviction last year, the first time in New Zealand. Christina, you might know this, or maybe the two of you in Auckland. Have you seen any tangible changes coming through following that conviction? Has there been an increased awareness, for example?
I think, one thing that happened here last year, which, you know, was the first in New Zealand, was Human Rights New Zealand held a forum in Wellington, or opened in Wellington. They then had workshops, sort of working groups in Auckland and Wellington, where there were industry representatives from, you know, agriculture, banking, universities, retail, all sitting around and sort of having some really open dialogue about forced labour, slave labour, which has never happened in this country. And just to have people talking about it and recognising that it's an actual issue in New Zealand, I think is a huge step. You know, even universities were sort of sitting there saying, well, you know, what role are we playing? We're bringing international students into this country and not actually talking to them about what the minimum wage is. So we've got students that are out there thinking $10 an hour, wow, that's huge money, because it's so far removed from what they'd be getting in their own countries. And still, you know, it's nowhere near what our minimum wage is, let alone a living wage. So, you know, when you're starting to ask these questions, that's the start, right?
Yeah, very much so.
Christina, what's happening in the New Zealand fishing sector?
I haven't done much work in the fishing industry since the reef flagging came into effect on the 1st of May 2016. So when the government announced that the reef flagging bill, when the reef flagging bill was passed.
What is that?
Okay. So we have the foreign charter vessel sector. And previously what was happening was that, for example, foreign vessels were coming in and fishing in New Zealand waters on behalf of New Zealand companies and quota holders. And the research that we did identified forced labour practices, extensive physical, mental, sexual abuse in the industry. The government launched a ministerial inquiry, and the inquiry came out with a number of very key recommendations, and then the government amended the Fisheries Act. And as part of the amendment of the Act, on the 1st of May 2016, all foreign vessels that were operating in New Zealand waters had to be reflagged as New Zealand vessels, meaning they came under New Zealand health and safety laws, plus employment law, etc.
And that makes it easier to control, I suppose.
It does. Mm. It does. But if we could go back to the human trafficking trial, there's actually been two court cases where there has been a human trafficking charge in the last 2 years. The first court case in Nelson, those that were being prosecuted were found not guilty of human trafficking, but guilty of the lesser charges of making false statements to Immigration New Zealand. And the second case in Auckland was where those that were being prosecuted were found guilty. One of them was found guilty of human trafficking. And I think what those two court cases have done is help to increase people's awareness of what's actually happening here in New Zealand in terms of trafficking, in terms of exploitation. At the human trafficking trial in Auckland, some of the victims said we were treated like dogs, and that's how bad the situation was for them. In the way they were treated and the money they actually paid to be able to get the job working in the horticulture sector, and the lack of wages they received.
It's shocking, isn't it, to think it actually is occurring here. Anything to add from Nikki and Michelle?
I just think that there's one thing, the Colmar Brunton Better Business, Better Future report in 2014 was an interesting document that was produced, and it's got some interesting statements in it. And there's some statements around that businesses that are addressing social issues are more likely to grow in the next year. So I think there's an emphasis on businesses to start looking at, the social issues of what they buy, what they do, and how they do things, and to do things better. So if there's an emphasis on returning a greater amount to your shareholders as a result of looking at some of these issues, then perhaps there's more of a movement within that. But it's another aspect of employment where businesses have a responsibility to be looking at addressing social issues.
Yep, and economy talks, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay, well, just before we get into our final section where we might try and put a little bit of a positive spin on some of this, Nikki and Michelle chose Teki Tane's Fallen Angels. Firstly, I think because he's a New Zealand musician, but also because he's very supportive of child labour free.
Down. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Korerotia on Plains FM 96.9. We're talking about human trafficking today, and it's been quite heavy going so far, but there are some successes. Ralph, you've touched on the improving conditions in some of the brothels in Thailand. Really good to hear. We've talked a little bit about the Modern Slavery Act in the UK and what California's doing, and expressed some hope that that may well also take place in New Zealand and other places. But anything else you'd like to talk about in terms of some successes you've seen in your different lines of work?
So one of the things that is starting to happen more and more in the sector is that as funders, so particularly institutional donors, become more experienced, they're applying a more nuanced and informed approach to where they place their money. So they're engaging in more sophisticated measuring and evaluation exercises because they've realised much money has been wasted in the past in ineffective programs. So that is really positive because they're holding donees working in the sector to account and actively monitoring the effectiveness of what they're doing. And as I mentioned before, the Interagency Coordination Group from the United Nations published this toolkit, which should help both anti-trafficking organisations to refine their strategies and consultants and donors to improve the evaluation of potential programs that they're looking to fund, so that we see an increase in the professionalism and the effectiveness of the work that needs to be done. I think there's also much greater awareness. It seems like every other week somebody's releasing a documentary or a printed media article on the topic around the world. I think there are more and more people becoming interested in the sector. Personally, I'd like to see more people with the relevant qualifications and training entering into it. We still have a lot of people entering the anti-trafficking sector with great intentions but no relevant skill sets. And like, it's great that people have got good intentions, it's just not enough anymore. The problem's too sophisticated. So we do need more people with relevant skills, which would include obviously legal, criminal justice, IT skills, media skills, social welfare and counselling skills, so that we're bringing a more qualified group of people to tackle a problem. And also innovation, you know, the different sort of IT things, the supply chain strategies, like the ones that Michelle and Nikki are looking at. Those sorts of things that are applying different innovations to see how do we tackle this problem in a new way, because some of the old stuff hasn't really worked.
Yeah, and I think for us, I mean, the Modern Day Slavery Act was it's not New Zealand, but it is a huge success in terms of it's created a huge amount of
platform.
Yeah, it's a platform, and it's created a lot of discussion around what other countries are doing. One of the things for me has been around consumers, and I guess I'm a little bit like you, Ralph, in that it is a fairly for every person that has the discussion and asks the question, where has it come from, that you're right, there's probably 10 that don't. But what I have seen and where it's been kind of really heartwarming is actually children. So what we've seen is schools are now undertaking whole year-long projects around, we had a school here in Auckland do it literally around child labour, but I know that there's also schools that have done around fair trade. There's my niece's school at the moment is working around the Syrian refugees. So their actual topics, their math, science, literacy, is actually all sort of based in these more ethical ways of behaving and being. And that sustainability, you know, in New Zealand, sustainability has just been really about the environment, and the conversation is now shifting to much more than that, and that to be a sustainable kind of country slash world, we have to change the way that we behave. So that is a success for me, and certainly around thinking about doing things differently, that we can't keep doing what we've always done because, you know, things aren't changing fast enough, and you're right, Russ, they are getting away on us. So what else can we do? What other things can we, what other innovations can we come up with? And, you know, let's sort of think outside the box.
And I think two of the successes here in New Zealand, we've already mentioned the successful human trafficking trial last year, and also the reflagging bill for the foreign charter vessel sector. And, you know, if we look in the media, increasingly we are seeing accounts of worker exploitation being reported. But again, I go back to one of my earlier points that often this is a hidden population. But I think what's happening is that Kiwis are becoming more aware that worker exploitation and forced labour practices are happening here in New Zealand. And as that awareness increases, then hopefully there will be further successes.
Nikki and Michelle, I have a question for you guys around how does Child Labour Free advocate for the children? Is it just a matter of trying to publicise the issues? Are you the ones going into the schools?
Here in New Zealand, we have done. We've gone into the schools and worked alongside the school in Auckland. Michelle sort of worked alongside them most of last year. Other schools have gone in and talked to the children. Then in terms of advocating sort of on a more global scale, it has been around sort of educating the consumer, and then with the Child Labour Free Foundation is currently working with FreeSet on the ground to provide childcare at one of their sites in Sonangachi in Kolkata. So, that's kind of where we're sitting at the moment.
So a lot of education.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Ralph, is that one of the tactics that Invader employs as well?
Not really, no. It's just ours is much more a criminal justice focus, so our work's primarily in Thailand itself. The work we do in New Zealand is more targeting donors because we rely on New Zealand public for funding the work we do. And, you know, to be honest, we've had great support from people. You know, it's been quite interesting. When I started this journey talking to people in 2014, the level of ignorance about human trafficking was enormous. You know, people had no idea. They thought slavery got wiped out in the 1800s. But that is changing now. And you know, when I returned to New Zealand in March, there was a lot more knowledge of the sector. The other thing I should say that I personally find encouraging is the number of people in the Gen Y population who have a very aroused social conscience and are willing to put their careers on hold and come over to Thailand with their skill sets or other parts of the world and get involved. Working in the United Nations, we've had a number of, I think I've had three New Zealand lawyers come to Thailand to work for us for nothing for a period of months just because of their passion and interest, and others working for others in this other organisations in the sector, either free or on very cheap salaries. You know, sort of survival-based salaries, just so they can make some sort of contribution, which is not something I saw my own generation at that time of their life. So I'm quite impressed to see.
It's Unitech, I think. It's called Festivals of the Future, and they run it every year. We went last year and the year before, and that is 18 to 25-year-olds. And they absolutely inspired me with their ideas and enthusiasm and just willingness, absolute willingness to accept that things have to change and that they're a part of changing, you know, making those changes. So it was awesome.
I imagine that comes back again to the point that you both have been bringing up around consumers and can the consumer play a role? And once you're aware of it, you have the option, don't you? You have the choice.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one of the things we always used to say is once you know something, you can't unknow it. And, you know, every day I learn something new, I do change the way that I purchase and, you know, the way that my company purchases. And I truly do think that when people truly know, you know, when they really pull back the curtain, it's a very difficult thing to not know that going forward.
Well, just to finish up then, have you got any final words that you would like our listeners to go away with? Pearls of wisdom.
Pearls of wisdom. you know, the power truly is in their hands. You know, I think you said before, Sally, you know, economics talk. So when people are voting with their feet or their wallets, that will make brands make a choice. When you're saying to a brand, where's this being made? You know, can you tell me who made it? And, you know, there's a number of different options
for brands to be able to answer those questions, and that they need to be making ethical choices. And seriously, consumers do hold that power. They absolutely hold that power.
Yep, definitely.
And possibly with a similar but slightly different context, we really do need to make it socially unacceptable in New Zealand for young men to travel to Southeast Asia for a sex holiday.
I'm
appalled and disappointed that when I hear accounts of uni students in their 20s saying, well, let's go to Thailand and have a good old time. And it's really time we just made that socially unacceptable. And that really starts with parents talking to their kids at home when they're old enough to understand the issue, but you know, talking about what is really happening around the world in terms of slavery and human trafficking, and how it's unacceptable for us as wealthy Westerners, because we are wealthy, to be exploiting the most vulnerable people in the world, because most of those sex establishments are heavily exploitative of very poor poor women, and we're only going to change that if we kill the demand, and that's, again, in our hands.
Yep, comes back to the choices you make, doesn't it?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I would like to say a very big thank you to all of you for coming in. Well, Christina for coming in, and the others of you for beaming in. It's not been that easy with the technology, but thank you so much, because it's such an important issue and it really, really needs to be talked about more, as we've said again and again throughout this show. Once people have heard something, once they're aware of it, they can't unhear it, they can't unknow it. So hopefully this will contribute to people's knowledge of what is human trafficking and encourage people to take those smarter decisions we've been talking about.
Thanks, Sally.
Yeah, thank you, Sally.
Okay, well, thank you so much to all of you. I really do appreciate it, and particularly given the slight difficulties with the technology, it's been fantastic to have you all contribute.
Thank you.